What's going on, everyone? Welcome to the show and welcome to Tim's First World Problems. He's sitting here sipping kombucha out of a wine glass.
Actually, you know what? I always drink a bottle of kombucha every day. And I like to drink it out of a wine glass because it makes you feel fancy. And you may remember, I had my original wine glass that my wife bought me for Christmas. And if you're watching the video, you can probably see it says Timothy's Life Potion. She got it engraved in my glass, but she bought me a really big one. And like the, I don't know what you call it, like the mouthpiece or whatever. I call it my chalice. It was very thin. It was super thin glass. And so I broke it. And I've been complaining about it for, I don't know, 5 months or so, because I just like to find annoying things and complain about them. And I knew that I was getting it for Christmas, and the day has finally come. So here I am with my brand new kombucha chalice.
Oh my God. There's so much that's amazing and problematic about this, man. I was going to make fun of the fact that Tim is sitting here toiling through the issues of having too nice of a view, because his new window at the new office now looks out over the mountainside of Colorado.
Snow-capped mountains.
Yeah, which are too, they're snow covered right now. And so it's reflecting too much light into his eyes. But, and just as, you know, just to bring everybody fully up to speed, there's a problem, which is that if he closes the shade, then it's not bright enough.
Yeah. And then I don't get the proper lighting.
Whatever.
I had no intentions for the opening of the podcast to go this direction, just so you know.
Oh me neither. No, I meant to talk about the lighting. I didn't realize we were going to talk about the chalice too, though. So good to see you, man. Happy last,
yeah, you too.
Last day of the year? Almost the last day of the year?
Almost tomorrow. Yeah. I'm excited. 2022 was good. It was challenging. It was a challenging year. The last 3 years have just been challenging. I mean, aside from COVID, like just life, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel so good to be here, man. I feel so good to be in Denver. I don't know. There's something about being here where you and I have talked about it before, and you've talked about this city many times. And I totally get what you were talking about. It's just, it feels great to be here. So I'm feeling super optimistic about the new year.
Oh, that's good to hear, man. Yeah. What's your experience been so far? So for people who maybe haven't heard me say this before, for me, I live in Austin, and that's because I grew up moving around. Austin was one of only two places that I've ever been that really felt like I could make it home. Like, it really felt like, oh, this got everything. It just feels like home as soon as you get there.
Yeah.
And the other place like that was Denver. And so I've told that to Tim before, ever since he said he was going to move there. So what was it that you found that kind of made you feel that way so far? Have you been able to put a finger on it? Because for me, no. I can't really say what it is. Like, the thing, no. The closest I can come with Austin is I say, Austin's cool because you can still buy beer in a paper cup out of somebody's like window at a backyard concert. You know, there's not a lot of rules. And I kind of like that. And there's like, that extends all the way up and down the chain. Like, it's the kind of place where you'll still stumble across, I don't know, like a taco stand in a neighborhood, you know, there's not a lot of rules. There's not a ton of order. And I kind of like that. With Denver, for me, it was everywhere in the city, you can see the mountains. I love that.
It's like jarring isn't the right word, because I feel like jarring has a bit of a negative connotation, but yeah, it happens like once a day. We're just like, holy shit. Like, look at that huge mountain range right in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I grew up in the city, and then like afterwards I lived in South Florida for 12 years, and I love the beach. You know, I didn't think I would ever appreciate anything as much as I appreciate the South Florida blue ocean, white sand, perfect beach. But man, these mountains are, yeah, it's stunning. So I can't put a finger on it either. I just feel really great to be here. I feel super happy.
Nice, man. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. Glad to hear everyone's settling in. And I'm excited for this. I'm excited for this year too. Wait, what'd you say?
I said, let's get to it.
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm excited for this year. Real quick, before we get into stuff, we got a bunch of stuff to cover today. We're going to talk a little bit about the SaaS company that Tim and I bought. We'll give you guys some updates on how that's going. I got a cool creator spotlight that I want to do. Very cool newsletter writer that I stumbled across this week. But before we get into it, I really wanted to start with a shout out to one of our listeners. This is a guy named Mike Taylor. Mike, he shared out the AI episode that we did with Steph and Cal last week or 2 weeks ago. And that was cool to see. So thank you, Mike. I looked into some of the stuff that he's doing and pretty interesting guy. He seems like he's in the L&D space. So if anybody hasn't heard that acronym before, that's learning and development, which is like course design for companies. And I was kind of excited when I saw this because I've always been pretty interested in that space myself. Like one of my dreams is or was to be like one of these people who goes around lecturing to different teams at companies and stuff and just gets paid like tons of money to fly around like at the Apple headquarters or at Google headquarters doing talks. So that's kind of the L&D space is designing those sort of like learning pathways for people. And he's got a newsletter about it. And he's done a couple of really interesting things with the newsletter. So one thing that I wanted to call out while we're looking at it, what's the newsletter called? It's called Friday Finds, which is cool. But he's done like two or three things that I really like. And this is one of the reasons that I love being in this space is because there's so many people who are being creative out here that it doesn't really, like, you're not limited to the big names everybody's heard from.
Yeah.
You can find people who are doing really interesting creative stuff that like have never crossed your radar before. So three things that he did recently, he did this end of year post, which I liked a lot. It was an email that came out and rather than just doing like a wrap up on the end of the year, he actually embedded a form straight into it. And he asked people for a little bit of feedback on the content. So he's like, it was like, what did you like? What should I keep doing, stop doing, and start doing? So basically just like pretty standard feedback. But I thought it was a cool idea to embed a form like right into the newsletter and get people interacting in that way. That was pretty neat. And then two other things that I just noticed kind of cruising through some of his backlogs is that he always embeds like a Spotify playlist in his newsletter too. Yeah. And it's like, it's got the player right there.
I love
that. And I'm like, that's really interesting. Now I'm seeing this on his website, so I'm not sure if it looks the same in the inbox, but I just love that idea. I mean, I know how Tim Ferriss, not our Tim, the other Tim, puts, he'll put like a song that he's listening to in his newsletter, but I've never seen him actually embed like a Spotify playlist. Yeah. So that's kind of a cool move. And then the last thing that Mike's doing a great job of, he's got like a shitload of affiliate links in the newsletter, which is smart. And this is, we've talked about this before. For people listening who might just be getting in like the early stages of building a newsletter audience, affiliate marketing is one of the most approachable ways to start monetizing newsletters. And it can be huge. Like, don't write this off. We've talked before about a newsletter called the Newsette here. They do $40 million a year, and a pretty good chunk of that comes through affiliate marketing for Amazon. So can be a huge business. But the beauty of like affiliate ads is that there's no real bottom threshold for how big your company has to be or how big your list has to be in order to start using them. So what I love about his setup is he markets the tools that he uses as like a professional. He's just, because his newsletter is for other L&D creators. So he's like, here's how I build presentations, and here's the tool I use for this, and here's the tool I use for that. And they're all just affiliate links, super useful for his audience, but also he's potentially making money on the back end on that. So shout out to Mike. Thanks for sharing.
What's his last name?
Taylor. And I can actually grab, let's see, what's his Twitter Mike handle? Taylor. Yeah, it's you, at T Mike T on Twitter. Thanks for sharing. And yeah, just a couple of cool things that I saw in his newsletter that I haven't seen before. So congrats on all that stuff.
Excellent. Thanks, Mike. Well, we have some updates with our company. As is always the case with new ventures, things go slower than you plan, expect, and hope that they would. However, I'm happy to say that so we're recording this on December 30th. I would say by January 4th, we'll be completely operational. We own all the assets now. There's two things that we're working on right now. One of them is getting over the Stripe account, because transferring Stripe accounts is actually kind of complicated and just like a lot of steps that you have to go through for obvious reasons. And the second one is just getting the two paywalls. And here's what we're going to experiment with. I think it's cool that we're basically just going to grow this company in front of other people and let people know what it is that we're learning along the way. Here's my approach. I presented this to you, Ethan. You agreed with it, are going along with it, and we're going to see how it goes. So we're going to launch it with two pricing tiers. If you see our product, what it is it's an auto Twitter DM. And in the auto Twitter DM, there's three custom links. So basically, if I message you and you're not there, you can use our product to send me an auto message. And it says, like, if you want to get in touch with me, or if you want to check out my stuff, here are three links. And so you can add three custom links to the automation. We're going to have two pricing tiers. One of them is going to be free. And with the free tier, you're not going to be able to add a free link. And the pleasedm.me link, basically like an advertising to ourselves, is going to be the custom link. And then in the $9 a month tier, there's going to be no pleasedm.me. There's going to be no branded link, custom link at the bottom of the DM. And the user has three links that they can add into it. So here's what I'm worried about. I'm worried that not having the branded link, even in the $9 a month, we're just going to miss opportunity. But I'm hoping, and like, we'll see what happens. Like, this really is going to be a fun experiment. I'm hoping that having the free option is going to allow us to collect so many email addresses that will make up for the miss that through just email sales and like good old fashioned marketing through email automations. And I mean, who knows, maybe we could put some Twitter guides together, like sales. I've closed a ton of deals in the DMs of Twitter. So like, I know it's a useful tool. That's my hope. I hope it works.
I like the way you position that. And I hope the big takeaway for people listening to this is the experimental nature of like the early days on these types of things. You don't really have to have all the answers super early on. What you have to be good at is getting stuff out the door and iterating based on feedback. I agree with you too, man. Can I throw an idea by you? In terms of, I agree that we're probably going to miss out on a lot of opportunities by pulling the branding off there. So why don't we just leave it? And then the value add is like you can include links with the paid version. And by the way, for people listening to this, like, there's no right or wrong answer. We'll probably end up testing like a lot of iterations of both of these. So maybe one day we'll test a free version with one link and then the paid is multiple links. Or maybe we'll test like, you know, there's a 30-day trial for free, and then it's after that it's all paid and you don't have a free version after that. There's a lot of different potential combinations, and our job over the course of the next few months is to figure out which is the best based on the other ways that we're able to grow the software. Like, the right answer will actually depend probably more on our acquisition strategy, right? And like how much it costs us to get somebody in the door. That will have pretty big impact on whether we can support free clients long term and what the value of those paid clients is. So there's a whole bunch of levers at play here. But yeah, what do you think? Why don't we just leave the branding on all of them?
For sure. I don't know, there's gotta be some psychological term for this, like maybe familiarity bias, right? But the only reason why in my head it's not is simply because I've seen it go this way on so many other software products. Like, that just seems to be the deal. I remember with Sumo, you can use a free Sumo version and you get like a couple amount of email pop-ups per month, and all of those pop-ups are branded. And then if you pay for it, now you have more pop-ups and the branding goes away. Same thing with ConvertKit. Same thing with Hello Bar. And so call it whatever you want. I'm making up this term, familiarity bias, but in my mind, that's the only reason. It's just because people who are like smarter than me have already done it that way. Totally. But I'm totally open to it. I mean, what's the worst thing that can happen?
Well, so I have two thoughts about this, and a lot of this thinking is just coming on the fly. So people listening to this can take it with a grain of salt. The first thought is we can always remove it later at the same price tier without changing price at all. But we can, but we can't necessarily put it back. Yeah, you know,
you can't add it.
Yeah, this is a tricky thing about setting price on any product. There's like a quick, I don't know, like slogan people use. What was it? It's like up fast and ditch down, which basically means when you're starting off with a new product, you want to raise the prices fast in order to find the ceiling of what people are really willing to pay for it. And then if you have to lower the price again, you don't just decrease the price. You pull features off and decrease the price. And the reason for that is, well, hopefully obvious. Like a lot of times you're going to undercharge out of the gate. And so you need to just push the price up really quick in order to figure out what is the product actually worth to your customer base. A great example of this was what Steph Smith did when she launched that book.
Yeah, the book.
I think you might have mentioned it to me. It was the
No, you mentioned it to me.
Oh, okay. Well, the thing she did was she basically she had a limited number of seats at each price tier. And so that created this incentive for people to act quickly, and it pushed basically, I think she set it up so it was like 15 or 30 people at each tier. And then once she sold those spots, the price went up by say $5 or $10, and it just kept doing that until sales tapered off. And then at that ceiling, she basically figured out, okay, this is about what people are willing to pay for it. And I think I've figured out where the threshold is. Okay. So you push the price up quick. And then if you have to lower it, you ditch features. And the reason you do that is that you don't piss off anybody who paid the higher price.
Yeah.
Right. So you're able to kind of maintain them as a customer if you want, or you can make the decision to refund some of their money or all their money or something like that. Reason number one why we might just want to keep it out of the gate is because we can always ditch it later, the branding, but it would be hard to put it back in if we decide that we kind of need it there. There was a second thought I had, but I kind of forgot it for a second, so it'll come back to me.
It's reminding me of a carpenter slogan where you can't put wood back on a board. Like, so you never could, like, if you're going to cut something, it's better to not cut off enough than to cut too much, because if you cut too much, the whole board is useless. Whereas if you don't cut enough, you can always cut more off, but you can't put it back on. And I just, the contractor lizard brain in my head was like firing off when you were saying that. I was like, yeah, like we could always remove a little bit more, but once you remove it, you can't put it back on. And so I think that's a really good approach. Yeah, I'm down. Let's do it.
You reminded me of my other thought too. The examples you gave are good ones. They're ones I'm familiar with. I think one difference between what we're doing and what they're doing is that our tool exists inside of Twitter.
Yeah.
And a lot of those are built to integrate into somebody's website. And so the incentives to have it look native are a little bit different. But also, I'm just not sure people care that much about having the branding there these days. Like, it's become so common to build on top of a stack of like no code tools. I mean, a great example of this would be Jasper.ai. So sure. $1 billion, I think they've hit $1 billion valuation. Yeah. Substack's another great example. But what I was going to get at with Jasper is that they don't even have their own pricing page. And I was just talking to a friend about this today, and he pointed it out as a great case study. When you go through their onboarding, they send you straight to Stripe's landing page to pay money. And then they send you back to the Jasper site to finish your onboarding. So things like that, and they're, you know, tens, hundreds of millions, $1 billion valuation. So I think it's become much more common to see branding from other companies pop up inside someone's stack. And if it helps us grow that much faster or get traction, I think it's at least worth just keeping it there to start off with.
Great. Let's do it. Problem solved.
Nice. Can I, okay, let me throw a couple other things at you or at our listeners too. So you mentioned the pricing thing. I found a cool resource. By the way, Tim and I, well, I won't speak for Tim. I don't know anything about pricing SaaS software. Nothing. Mm-mm. But there's this company called ProfitWell, and they're pretty neat. Anybody who hasn't heard of them, they're basically, I think it's a SaaS product, and somehow it helps companies with subscription products. Let's see what they say. Drive subscription revenue while you sleep. So it's revenue automation products that automatically reduce cancellations, optimize pricing, and give you accurate free revenue reporting.
Okay, hold on a second. I hate that. Let me read that like 8 more times because I don't even know what the hell that means. Hold on. Revenue automation products that automatically reduce cancellations, optimize pricing, and give you accurate free revenue reporting. Okay, I got it. The fact that they have automation and automatically, like three words apart from each other, just made my brain completely flip over.
This is a really cool company. I actually don't know much about their product, but I do know their founder. He publishes a lot of really interesting information on Twitter, as you can imagine, because they're linked into the reporting for a whole bunch of subscription-based companies. So he's got incredible data on like how companies are performing financially. So this is Patrick. That's Patrick Campbell. He's the founder of this company. You can find him on Twitter. I believe it's at Paticus. Anyways, the other reason that I'm familiar with them is because they publish a ton of great information on exactly this, like how to build subscription companies. And they have an entire media network. It's called, what is it called? It's called Recur, R-E-C-U-R, which is, they kind of bill it as like the world's first media network focused exclusively on subscription-based companies. So they've got podcasts, they've got blogs, they've got guides. And the thing I want to highlight for people here is, and I'll show this, can I share my screen or no? I don't really need to share my screen. I can't, you might dig this.
Yeah, share your screen. I'm looking at it, but I like doing it for the video.
They have this report on SaaS pricing strategy, and it's 140 pages all about how to really think about this.
It's
a lot, but I'm so excited to dig in and understand this because I've actually read this or like sections of this once before. I don't remember everything that I came away with, but the one big idea that I did come away with was the idea that split testing pricing on a SaaS product is not the best way to figure out what your optimal pricing should be. There are other really well-developed like methods for finding that price point. And I don't remember what any of them are, but they really do a good job of like laying them out in here and teaching the strategy. So we're going to link off to this for people who are interested. But very cool company. Wanted to give them a shout out. I'm planning to dig into this and just kind of nerd out on pricing strategy so that as we continue testing these different formats, we'll, have like reasons in case people ask us, like why are you pushing the price up or why is this price this way? I feel like it'd be helpful to be able to point to some of this stuff.
I'd love to read it. I'll read it with you. Sometimes I can be like self-deprecating in this podcast just because we like poking fun of ourselves. There's a lot of things that I really feel comfortable with, even with pricing, like on lead gen. I totally understand pricing. I know how to get as much money as possible while still making it good for your clients. It's just, there's a whole new world for us. And so, I guess the only way to figure this out is just to figure it out. And so that's what we're doing.
Yeah. And I think, and that's the other thing too. It's like a lot of this is for more for listeners than anything else. Like this will be interesting for us to read and that's great. But I'm also super comfortable just testing, like throwing shit at the wall. Yeah. One reason to read this would be to be able to say something to people here in this podcast that they probably haven't heard before. So, you know, I think that's one of the cool things about doing the pod is that like we have stacked reasons for learning things, which I feel pretty lucky about too.
Yeah.
So that was one thing. And the only other thing I wanted to say about this, did I tell you my story about Steph using this app?
No.
Okay. So this has been really fun. And I don't know if there's other people out there who are kind of on the fence, maybe thinking about taking this
thing. Using Please DM
me? He's a user. Yeah.
What? No way.
Yeah. Dude, I've gotten two different DMs from people who are already users.
And it's so funny.
Yeah. So what's funny about this is when you first showed me this, people can go back to that episode. I literally said, I'm like, you know, when I see this, the person that I'm thinking of is Steph Smith, because wow, she gets so much inbound and she's also got really good rules about like how she handles her time. And then a couple of days or maybe a week or so ago, hold on, I'll get the text right here. She tweeted, it's taken me so much unlearning to internalize that just because someone slides into my inbox, that doesn't mean I owe them a response. And so I just texted her and I was like, ah, that's so funny that you say that. Tim and I just bought this software company. What do you think? And she goes, no way. Well, for one, I'm already a user. And then we just had a conversation about it from there. But, and I've gotten, I can't remember who else texted me about it too, but it's been so fun to have like just this one cool thing to kind of relate to my friends on, you know, because like Steph's a friend, a colleague, somebody I don't get to talk to that much because we're just all really busy these days. So it's been fun to kind of have just another touch point in this world that's like a reason for people to get together and just trade ideas and talk about stuff. And so the takeaway that I think I kind of hope people get from that is like, if you're thinking of doing this same thing, maybe thinking of acquiring a SaaS company, and maybe it's something to do with your industry, there are reasons to do it besides just the money. Like there's a kind of a fun social component to it too. Or at least that's the way it's played out for us so far. So shout out to Steph. She also said, she's like, I guess I'm gonna have to start paying for this soon, huh? And I'm like, yep. Which maybe that's the last thing. So yeah. Last thing to talk about. We had to make this decision about whether or not to charge existing users. And I think, I think we settled on, we're going to leave it free for anybody who already had it. Actually, I probably shouldn't even say that. Bleep that whole section out so that nobody rushes over to the page after they hear this and get it. But yeah, we're going to leave it free for people who already had it because we want to just like kind of like keep them around, keep them happy, and start learning from them about like what the tool means to them, what how it's being used out in the wild. But we had this really interesting experience the other day where the payment gateway is back up,
yeah,
on the lifetime subscription, and it's accidentally already made money. So do you have any updates on that?
We made another sale.
Really?
Yeah.
You gotta start.
I know. Okay, but hold on. Before we move on to the creator spotlight, I had something interesting, which I can relate to about this, which is why I still think it's a good idea to leave it free for everybody. For the people who already,
okay,
for everybody that already paid, they're getting grandfathered into the free one. Because something innate about people, it infuriates people when to have something that they've already accepted get ripped away from them. And I'll give you the only reason I'm saying this is because I know how much you like it when I make fun of Mighty Networks, but I had another terrible, terrible experience with them yesterday. And I'll tell you what happened. Sobriety Engine is the recovery community that is attached to Sober Nation. It's free. It's a free community. Anybody can do it. It's how I build my email list. And it's like really cool in there. Regardless, I have to pay a monthly subscription on Mighty and my business debit card expired. And so I looked back, they sent me emails, which is fine. I didn't see the emails and my monthly payment declined. And so they put me on the free version. The first thing that bothered me is that when they did that, they deleted all of my content. Whereas typically it's like we're going to store your content. And then if you pay it, you can get it back. They didn't do that. They just deleted everything. I thought that was kind of annoying, but also my fault, you know? So like, what are you going to do? I'm not that butthurt about it. This is the part that really infuriated me. Now that I was free, I am no longer allowed to export all of my contacts, even though they're my contacts. So all of my members and stuff like that, like I can't export their email addresses because, you know, I want to rebuild my community. And the whole reason why I had that community was to build a newsletter. So the very first thing I wanted to do is get them on ConvertKit. And there's just a huge red arrow that says like, this is for paid members only. And so immediately I went to cancel it. And they sent me this thing like, why do you want to cancel? I was like, because you guys are hooking me to pay you for something that's already mine. And so then of course they sent me the spreadsheet of all the contacts and they said like, here's your spreadsheet. Would you consider rejoining? And of course I said no. And so when we just had this conversation about making people pay who already have been grandfathered in, that was the first thing I thought about. Where like at the end of the day, it's not that big of a deal. You know, like if I had to pay the $39 to pay for 1 month to get all my contacts back, like it's totally worth it. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily like a logical monetary decision. It's an emotional decision that exists somewhere in people where it's like, this is already mine. And now you're ripping it away from me. And I was so mad about it. I was so mad. And I think that if we did that to people, we would make them mad as well. And I don't want to do that. I want people to feel good about our product so that they don't jump on a podcast and talk shit about it like I'm doing right now.
That's a perfect example. Right? And you know what? I'm usually the guy who kind of comes to the defense of, is it always Mighty Networks or was it Circle at 1.2? Okay. Yeah. I usually come and defend you guys, but I'm not gonna do that this time. That's pretty rough.
That's rough. Right?
I'll tell you, the thing that pisses me off more is the deletion of the content. That seems like whatever. I'm sure every team's got their reason for doing it, but
yeah,
like what kind of content did they delete? Would you have to reset up all your like
not even
courses and stuff like that?
Years of content, like
no, that got deleted.
Yeah,
that can't possibly be true.
The whole structure of it, all of the spaces that I created, all the events I created, all the groups I created. It's just
even if you gone. Paid for it, if you paid for it, they couldn't restore that.
I don't know.
Okay, that's
at that
like...
point. I really don't think so. I don't think so. I think the whole thing just got wiped out.
All right. Well, I'm gonna leave it with a maybe because that to me seems insane. Like we'd have to have
maybe.
A flak jacket. You have to whoever the creators would have to wear a flak jacket everywhere they went if they messed with that many.
Yeah,
networks.
It could be a maybe. I don't know. I don't want to put that out for sure. But
yeah,
100%. And then when they tried to get me back, I emailed them and said, like, I'm canceling simply because you're holding my own contacts hostage over me, and like, I'd rather lose 5,000 contacts than pay you $40 right now, which is completely illogical. But it's just how deep that goes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to do that to our people.
That's understandable. Okay, so if that's the case, takeaway there for people is, yeah, how emotional some of those decisions are. Yeah, great point. So that is the update on please DM me. We'll see where it goes next.
Yeah.
And I think what we're going to do is we're going to keep doing little updates inside of the show from week to week. I don't know if we'll always keep them as long as this, but, you know, it's exciting stuff. And I think you guys can let us know what you think. Is this helpful? Is it interesting? Holler at us and let us know. And also, I would like to know what our audience is building. So, I mean, a bunch of them have to have SaaS products that they're building on their own.
Sure.
So holler at us and let us know, like, what stage of the journey you're in with that. All right, man. Do you want to talk about this creator spotlight?
I do. I'm excited because you brought up some really cool aspects before we hit record. And we haven't done one of these in a while, actually. We've been, like, talking about ourselves a lot recently. So I'm excited to see what else is going on out there.
Have you heard of Chanel Basilio?
No.
Okay.
You know way more people than me. Like, never forget this. You're way cooler and way more connected than me. I don't know anybody either. You know everybody.
No. But, I mean, I'll take cooler. I stumbled across this woman the other day. How did I even come across her? I forget how I came across her stuff, but you know what, you and me have the exact same hobby, but in different areas. So where you're always like out kicking the tires on like different business opportunities, which is how you found, you know, that's how you kind of found this software. It's how you've got yourself into ConvertKit's ad network, even when at a time when like that's not like an easy thing to do. I do the same thing, but with creators. And so I stumbled across this woman, Chanel Basilio. I think I'm pronouncing her name right.
I think that's it.
She's so cool. What she's been doing is these really deep breakdowns on creators. Specifically, she takes some of the best known people in the creator space and then like reverse engineers their growth and shows how they went from 0 to 50K subscribers.
What a great tagline. Let me just read this. I reverse engineer how top creators get to 50K plus subscribers. That's so good. I know exactly what you're about, Chanel. Appreciate that.
Yeah. She's doing a really great job. And I can't quite remember how I came across her in the first place, but she did this breakdown on the Generalist's newsletter. And I wanted to kind of go through it. I think you're going to dig this. Like if I just do a quick scroll, like I think you'll geek out on this just as much as I did, because it's a super long form piece of content, lots of cool like stuff from the archives. She goes way back in time and digs through data to show like how their audience grows, not just the tactics they use, but actually like what the numbers are at each stage. So this is, you know, his email list growth versus his Twitter following. And she gets a lot of this from, you know, interviews and old issues of the email and stuff like that. Like, this is just everything I love about long form content. And this is one of my favorite things to do. So it's really cool to see somebody else doing it at such a high level. And what I wanted to do here was go through one meta idea, which is why her approach kicks ass and why this will always work. So people listening to this, you could do this exact same thing in your space. But then I thought we'd spend a couple of minutes just talking through the four key aspects that she highlighted for why Mario's been so successful with the Generalist, which are right here. So first, why don't we talk about the meta approach? I think that there is always going to be an opportunity for super detailed research like this into the archives for a few reasons. One of it is because there's like always new up-and-comers in pretty much any industry, and nobody ever hears about them until they get to like a certain amount of success. So no matter what industry you're in, whoever the main players are, chances are very little is known about their super, super early days. And like, this is the myth of the overnight success. You know, you start seeing somebody's name and it's pretty much just assumed that they like hit a home run kind of out of nowhere. But if you really take the time to dig into the archive and go through like how they actually came up, what you'll often find is two things. One, it took way longer than most people realize. And two, if you really know where to look, there's a whole bunch of cool stories you can surface about what really made the difference in their growth. So I love this approach, and it's one that I think will never, ever get old. It's like, it's infinitely repeatable across industries. And I think it sounds like Tim agrees, just based on.
Oh, certainly. I'm not in my head. Yes. When you say across industries, that was actually where my brain went, because it made me think of sports with Huddle Up. A lot of the content that Pompliano, I know, but huddleup.substack.com, that's his newsletter.
I think it's Joe.
Joe Pompliano. I've never met him or anything. I've read a couple issues. A lot of the stuff that he writes is about, for lack of a better word, like founder stories or like personal stories about how it all started for this person, this league, this like situation. And it's always like very, very intriguing. So I agree. When you said across all industries, that was the part that really made me go like, oh yeah, like you really can take this approach and apply it to anything.
Yeah, it works. It literally works for everything. And the other, one of the other reasons this is so successful is it takes a lot of time to do it. And so 99% of the people who even report on these industries will never do it. So like, what are examples of this? We're not just talking about, if you were to take Chanel's approach, what she appears to do is she will sit down and like pull all the interviews that somebody's done, right? Text, podcast, whatever, and go through them and combine insights. And what's really interesting about that is that people are willing to share different things at different points in their journey. So by going through a series of interviews, rather than maybe just like one or two stories about how somebody grows, you get a much more well-rounded view of their picture. Mm. I do this a lot with companies at Trends too. And the reason I do it is because most companies are not willing to share their current revenue, but they'll share last year's revenue. So if you just pull, you know, interviews with the same company over the course of the last like 5 or 6 years, you can actually plot how their revenue grows year over year. And like they don't hide the same information over time. So there's a lot of benefits to being willing to like dig back through the archive. But also you just find stuff that you wouldn't normally find because nobody takes the time to look for it. So in the case, this, she isolates like four key levers that kind of got Mario to the point that he is. And by the way, for anybody who maybe isn't familiar with this, Mario runs a newsletter called The Generalist. It's a paid newsletter, or it's a like a paid community where he writes about upcoming tech trends. And I think one of the reasons he's impressive is because he's like a solo operator, but also he was pretty early to it. So he took a leap on newsletters back in early 2020 or so, which was really before it was as popular as it is now.
Yeah.
And you know, his first year in business, he did something like $300,000 off that newsletter. And what Chanel reported on was like the size of his list was only 60,000 people. So it wasn't a huge list, and he was able to drive like a ton of revenue. But it, you know, it's grown since then as well. I would be surprised if he's not doing somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million a year, maybe even more. So the four key things that she kind of highlights about how he did this, and this is what I wanted us to jam on just real quick as a super familiar with Mario, but these four things are like universal. So for Chanel, she says the four things that he did that really made his newsletter work were: one, writing the most comprehensive articles on the planet. That's a little gratuitous, but like he does do like really super deep dives. He uses collaborations to amplify the quality and the reach of his content, which is pretty cool. I'll dig into that in a second. He's become a super connector, which involves more about how he treats his audience rather than anything that he does outside of it. And then there's a cool tactic that he uses in the newsletter called the Puzzler, which drives engagement through the roof. So we've talked a little bit about why comprehensive content is so interesting already. I won't dig into that more, but like what Mario, like he writes like 5,000 to 15,000 word articles. These are like super, super detailed deep dives on stuff. And again, the point to drive home there is just most people are never going to take the time to do it. So if you are the person who's willing to go that deep in your industry, you will always start to find people who want to read it. And I think there's a little bit of a hack there too, which is you get a lot more respect quicker for writing those kinds of deep dives because people in the industry understand how much work goes into that. I don't know. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, so much so that I feel like I repeat the same thing over and over again sometimes, which is probably a good thing, but I don't know how much simpler the world could be with this stuff sometimes. If you want to get ahead, find an industry that you're super, super interested, passionate about, or even something that you're willing to put the work into that you see an opportunity, and just write the most detailed, I don't want to use the word long form because it's not necessarily about making content for the sake of making content, but just write something that is so remarkable. Even if only a few people see it, those few people have to acknowledge how much work and how much value it brings. You know, there'll never be a better way to do it than to, even if you do one a month, you know, if you can somehow get 10,000 words a month in and just write ridiculous long form guides that aren't fluffy, are to the point, and are valuable about anything. It's just like, you will get ahead. There's no way that you can't get ahead, because somebody's going to find it and it'll make an impression on them.
Well said. And by the way, this is one of the reasons that I don't spend a lot of time focusing on growing my Twitter following. We joked about this last week, but like, I didn't put a lot of effort into growing Twitter this year. I think I added a total of 1,000 followers. And there's a few reasons for that. One is because I don't place a ton of value in follower count, even though there is value there. It provides a lot of clout. But for me, like, the real value of Twitter is, can you get the work that you want when you want it? And I already have more people than I can manage reaching out just through the long form content that I do publish there, that it's very, it's like tempting for me. I turn Twitter off. That's the first thing that goes for me, because it's, as soon as I turn it on again by publishing more long form stuff, I get a whole new batch of inbound messages. So in the back of my mind, I know it's like, I could grow this. I'm not really sure what I would do with it if I did grow it. And so I don't, but I do know that I know how to turn it on if I ever needed to, I think, which is why I don't focus on it that much. But all of that speaks directly to your point of, the only reason I get that is because the only stuff that I really publish on Twitter is shortened versions of super long form research. Yeah. And it doesn't take many. It took like one really good piece to turn that tap on. And you only need like one or two people reaching out to you with work per month to build like a pretty good business off of it. I've never really tried with consulting in the newsletter space, but I totally agree. That long form work, you don't need a lot of it in order to get the kind of outcome that you really want in terms of money, dollars.
Yeah. And there's just as much of an argument to say that, like, what's the expression that I use sometimes? Don't use social media to build a business and then grow your social media. You know, like, if you want Twitter followers, the best thing to probably do is create some kind of remarkable website where people are going to be interested in the other aspects of you. Scott Galloway comes to mind, where his newsletter, No Mercy, No Malice, I think it was called, is how he got all of his followers, because he would just write like one long form newsletter a week. Or what's the other guy, the professor guy?
Oh, Adam Grant.
Yes, thank Wait, you.
Is he the guy? Did he write? That's definitely who you're thinking about. He's the only thank other famous.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. For people who are just rejoining us. Yeah. Okay. So I forget what we were talking about there.
I have no idea what we were talking about.
So long form works well. Comprehensive content always going to work well.
Yes.
The three other things that she mentions was his collaborations, his ability to be a super connector, and his engagement strategies. So real quick with the collaborations, here's a smart thing that I didn't think about. This guy, Mario, will co-write articles with subject matter experts across the industry. So what he'll do is he tweets about a topic that he wants to write about, and then people will reply with, you know, either their thoughts or like credentials. He'll kind of sift through the internet of his or his audience to figure out who knows the most about this thing. And then he sets up a call and all of them work together to figure out an outline. And then everybody goes off and they write their respective pieces and he kind of curates the whole thing. Right.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And so that results in two things. First, incredibly comprehensive content, which we've covered before. But second, when it comes time to then share the content, he's getting reach of all those people as well, which I thought was just super smart.
I love that.
You know, that kind of ties into this third thing of being a super connector. The big thing that Chanel mentions about this is that inside the private community that Mario runs, he links up every member with at least one other member once a month. Now, I don't know how he does this, but if I had to guess, I would hope he's using an app for it. I mean, maybe he's doing it manually, but there are apps that can do this like automatically, like Donut. The apps kind of suck sometimes because it's not as personal. And sometimes you like whoever you get connected with, they don't care, so they don't respond. But for people thinking about this, we've talked before about the difference between an audience and a community. The difference is an audience is a one-way communication stream, or it's you to them to you. A community is you to them to you, and them to each other. So linking members of your community up is what makes it a community. And a really great way to think about this, if you're ever struggling with like community building strategy, is just ask yourself, who in your group have you connected this week? And that's it. If you just start there, that's like the most important part of community building. And if you just kind of go back to that place, that will clarify what the priorities are for building a community at any given point in time. Just connect two people in your audience who should know each other. That's community building. That's all you need to know. And then this last thing real quick is the puzzler. This is part of his engagement strategy. And I love this. So basically he will include some sort of like brain teaser in the newsletter and ask people what they think the answer to it is. And then they write in, and it's a simple little hack, but it does a few things. First, obviously it gets people excited to open the newsletter because they want to see what the brain teaser is. They also maybe want to see if they got it right the last week. So, you know, they'll open for that reason. But more importantly, it gives him this conversation that he can have with his audience, where now he can mention people from the audience in the newsletter. And so Chanel highlights an example where he basically comes out and says, oh, you know, congratulations to so-and-so who guessed such and such last week. Like, that was a great guess. Whatever. You were right. You were wrong. The big point here is people love seeing their name in print. And a lot of people don't know this, but this is actually why your late night show hosts do the man on the street routine. When they go out, like when Jimmy Fallon or whatever goes out on the street, or who's the guy who does this a lot? Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah. Jimmy Kimmel.
They go out on the street and ask questions. That is so that people know they're going to be on TV and they tune in. And they tell all their friends that they're going to tune in. And it's like it's an audience growth tactic. It's not just because people care about like what your average person on the street thinks the answer to a riddle is.
I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
So what is, other than the puzzler, what is a man on the street tactic that we can all apply to our newsletters? It makes me think of my own newsletter. There's nothing about this that I do. I don't do any kind of engagement. I write my stories and that's it. Yeah, man. What else can I do?
So there's a couple. We do a version of this here. Like one of the reasons, I mean, we do shout outs at the beginning of every episode. And again, that's not like, you know, there's only one shout out. So I don't know how much people tune in just to hear their own name. I don't really think that's it, but it's important to have that two-way conversation with the audience and like make sure that people are seen and they know that when they do things, we notice, right? So I think, I'm not sure if you do a version of that. I would guess that you probably do, but the big takeaway there is like, doesn't have to be a man on the street thing. Just pay attention to what your audience is doing and shout them out for that. So like Sam was always really great at this with trends. What he used to do is, if people like, if something funny happened, even if there was a problem, people wrote in with a complaint or something like that, he would mention people by name in the newsletter, never in a bad way, but like when the first issue of Trends went out, his personal phone number was accidentally mentioned. Like it was attached in the address at the very bottom of the phone number. And so a handful of people called him. And that's a problem when you have like hundreds of thousands of people getting an email. So he took it out of there, but mentioned it in the top of the newsletter and said, oh, when we sent the last issue, like I accidentally attached my phone number, fixed that. But hey, John and Kara, like in California, it was great chatting with you, you know? So just like little mentions like that. But another way to do this, and this is a little bit more tactical, I do this, is you can use tools like Twitter to listen in on what your audience is doing. So in my case, I develop a list of people in our community that I know who I want to pay attention to, and I follow them. And I just call out stuff that they share from time to time. So if, you know, if they have a big win, like maybe their company hits a certain level of revenue, shout that out. Or if they get mentioned somewhere by somebody else and it's like a big deal, shout that out. You can do this with Google alerts too. You can set Google alerts for certain members of your audience. And like, I think there's a benefit to doing this at scale. So if you have, you know, if you have an email sign up, add a form to that and be like, yo, drop your Twitter link here if you want us to keep tabs on what you're doing, you know, so that we can see what you're up to. Yeah. I think people might be willing to do that. And then you just create a list on your Twitter account of all your audience members, scroll through that, and then shout people out. It's really just about talking about your audience, you know?
Yeah. Getting people excited to be a part of what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And showing you're paying attention to them, you know? Mm. So I think that's about it. But this was a really cool case study. I really like what Chanel's doing.
I really love it too. Can you send me the link to that article? I want to read it. And just one more time, Chanel, what is it? I'm going to follow her on Twitter now.
Sure. So it's Chanel Basilio, and it's at Chanelco on Twitter. So Chenellco. And we'll link up all this stuff in the show notes as well. So I'll send the link through to the Mario case study.
Cool.
To her Twitter account. And anything else we've mentioned here today.
All right, Chanel, I'm following you. I can't wait to read your newsletter. It's a great looking website, by the way, too. I love it. I mean, it was very minimalist. I like the branding that she created. I like the little visuals. She's like telling a story right away. She's letting you know. I mean, we mentioned even the tagline in her Twitter bio, but that vibe, that clarity about what she's trying to do and who she's trying to do it for was all over her website. So I hope you go check it out.
Yeah. Cool, man. Well, is there anything else you wanted to cover, chat about?
No, I'm going to go walk around this lake and stare at this mountain.
Make sure you put some shades on, because I know the snow yes, can be I real will. Reflective right now. I'm picturing Tim walking around the lake with his chalice of kombucha in his hand. His sunglasses.
Oh my God, I know.
And the neighbors are like, man, too,
because my life is like so routine, almost to the point where I've eliminated like all decision from my life completely. And so if there's something that you can picture me doing, like there's a high probability that I'm already doing it, because I don't veer from the path, you know? So yeah, that's a good visual, but it's not far from the truth.
Chalice walks. Yeah. All right, everybody. Well, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for checking out these websites that we mentioned, the creators we mentioned. Give us a shout. Let us know what you're up to. And we will see you next week, or next year and next week.
All right, everyone. Appreciate you listening. Talk soon.